May I just thank Amicus for its assistance to the court.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Tom Jackson. I represent the petitioners in this case. In this case, the issue before the court is whether EPA complied with the law in fundamentally revising its regulations that govern renovation activities in homes that may contain lead-based paint. This case presents the court with an example of a situation in which an agency has fundamentally reversed its position and has done so without any new evidence, without any experience, given that the rule here was eliminated, fundamentally changed by EPA before it had even implemented it.
So the rule you're seeking is that an agency cannot reevaluate the evidence it has and decide that it should revise a rule that is has very recently become effective?
That's not what you're saying, Your Honor. We would concede, obviously, that a federal agency has the authority to change its mind. I mean, the courts have been very clear that that's the case. So we don't contest that proposition.
No, I'm focusing on your point about no new data, no experience, or virtually no experience under the rule.
Yes, but what we're saying, Your Honor, again, we're not saying that the agency couldn't do what it did, but what we are saying is that under the APA, the agency has to be held to a higher standard,
but
if you will.
Now you're really, really in trouble, because Justice Scalia confronted exactly that question in Fox and said there is no higher standard. He also said you don't need new data. So maybe before Fox, you could have made the argument you make, and in fact, the dissenters in Fox say you could have made the argument before. But now we're confronted with Justice Scalia's opinion, and I think the bottom line of the opinion is that a new administration can come in and evaluate exactly the same thing, and as long as either alternative was a reasonable one, can adopt the one that fits its preferences. And when that one gets voted out, the next administration can come in and reverse it again. That seems to be the point of Fox.
Well, again, Judge Garland, we're not saying that a new administration can't come in.
But you said there was a higher standard for reversal, and the court expressly rejected that argument.
I think what the court said in Fox, Judge Garland, was that there was no general rule that was the case, that there was a higher standard when an agency changed its case.
Are you offering a reason why there should be a special rule here, assuming the general rule is against you?
I think if you look at Justice Scalia's opinion in Fox, Justice Scalia said that sometimes an agency must provide more detailed explanation. He recognized in his opinion that there are exceptions to the general rule. He said when, for example,
to make the opinion hold together, that would mean that there were particular facts or circumstances that made the new conclusion in some respect counterintuitive, so that compelled the agency to come forward with something that would justify it. Something special, that is to say, that agencies also got to have some justification.
Agency certainly does have some justification for changing its mind. And what we're saying here, Judge Williams, is
not exactly changing its mind. It's got to have a reason for what it does.
That's correct. And what we're saying here is, in this kind of situation, we think that the opinion in Fox, in fact, all the opinions in Fox, really support the notion here that in this situation where the agency, it's where the agency's change in position is based on a issuing what are essentially new factual findings that directly contradict the factual findings that underlay its prior position, that in those situations, I think all the justices in the court recognized that a more detailed explanation is required. Justice Scalia said, again, sometimes an agency must provide more detailed explanation when, for example, its new policy rests on factual findings that contradict those which underlay earlier policy. What you have here...
What factual findings here contradict the other findings?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, when EPA originally issued the rule here, what I'll refer to as the renovation rule, with the opt-out provision in place, the agency found that the rule with the opt-out provision was safe, was effective, and was reliable for the purposes of minimizing hazards to particularly children under six and pregnant women. Those are the focus of the statute. And so EPA found originally that the rule, as then constituted with the opt-out provision, was safe, was reliable, was effective. EPA, in eliminating the opt-out rule, said essentially the opposite.
Well, it said it's safer, more effective, and more reliable. It didn't say that, it never says that the previous rule, I think the way you put it in your brief was, the previous rule was consistent with the statute. And I don't think the others, I mean, I suppose there were obviously parties who thought that that was wrong, but the agency's position is not that the previous rule is not consistent with the statute, but that its own rule is also consistent with the statute, and that's all that's necessary.
Well, again, I think, Judge Garland, that the agency here has reversed course based on different factual findings. It essentially said that the facts that justified the inclusion of the opt-out provision no longer justify, in its new view, the continued
use. It wants a safer, more effective, more reliable rule. That is, it wants to protect people who would not have been protected by the opt-out rule.
Well, it's essentially finding, I think, Judge Garland, that the new rule is that the agency says that it can't find that it's safe, effective, and reliable with the opt-out provision, and therefore it needs to get rid of the opt-out provision in order for...
I find it saying exactly that, because, I mean, I read it certainly exactly the way Judge Garland did, that the 08 rule was good, and this rule, is, we conclude, is better because of the additional persons protected and what it saw as the reasonableness of the cost.
Again, I think, Judge Williams.
Maybe you can point us directly to some particular fact as opposed to a sort of judgment of prudence, a particular fact that the agency reversed itself on. Because I certainly didn't see that.
Well, the agency found, for example, originally that the so-called disclosure rule was sufficient to protect women and children who might move into young children and pregnant women who might move into homes.
This is surely a prudential judgment, right? In other words, at least absent extraordinary social science data, which has not been presented here on either side, and perhaps even in the presence of extraordinary social science data, that's got to be a judgment call, hasn't it, to the effectiveness of disclosure?
Well, but the with respect to the, I mean, there's certainly an element of judgment there, Judge Williams, there's no question. But in deciding that you know, originally EPA had said the disclosure rule was sufficient because of the way it operates. It provides...
Sufficient is one of those foggy terms, is it not? Good enough, right? And someone looking at the same data can say, well, on reflection, we don't think it's good enough. And
the agency says, I'll read for you, is EPA believes that implementing the regulations without the opt-out provision promotes, to a greater extent, the statutory directive to promulgate regulations covering renovation activities in target housing. Now, that doesn't mean that the previous rule couldn't have survived the kind of deferential review that we give to regulations under State Farm, but they prefer to cover to a greater extent than the previous rule does. I mean, again, it's quite apparent what's happened here is a new administration comes in and has a different view. If that administration gets voted out, the new administration can come in and reverse again to the opt-out rule. But that's not the question here is only whether what the current administration believe. This is what Fox says. I'm not stating my own view. I'm stating what Fox says. In fact, Fox actually says you do not have to prove that it's better. And Scalia italicizes that word. The administration need not demonstrate to a court's satisfaction that the reasons for the new policy are better than the reasons for the old. It suffices that the new policy is permissible under the statute, that there are good reasons for it, and that the agency believes it to be better. And that seems to be exactly what the agency is saying in that sentence I read. They think it's better, that it achieves the statutory goals to a greater extent.
Well, there's no question that they think it's better, Judge Garland. Again, we don't contest that at all. But again, what we're saying here is EPA, in reaching that judgment, has taken, we believe, a fundamentally different view of the facts.
It has, let's assume that characterization is correct. You still have to show it's arbitrary, capricious, not in conformity to the law, the usual standards. So the question is, how have you done that?
But again, what we're saying here is that what's necessary is a more detailed explanation of why
where
the old judgment.
More detail?
Excuse me?
Where is it exactly that you want more detail? I mean.
Well, for example, Your Honor, again, let's go back to the disclosure rule. Because again, the EPA's principal rationale here, we think, for changing its mind was that the opt-out rule doesn't provide protection for young children, children under six, and pregnant women. And the main reason they point to for that is the possibility that young children and pregnant women can move into homes that were previously renovated without following the strictures of the work practices under the renovation rule.
Because they won't have known that it was recently renovated, and they didn't have a choice about opting out, and the previous owners did the renovation, and there's stuff left because it wasn't done in the certified manner, right?
Potentially.
That's their argument. I'm just saying, I'm only repeating.
That,
that's their argument, right?
That is their argument.
Why is that unreasonable, arbitrary, capricious? Why is that? Why is that arbitrary to reach that kind of conclusion?
Well, again, the EPA's initial judgment was that the disclosure rule would provide people moving in information about lead-based hazards in the home. That's what
there's no disclosure rule
is about.
There's no disclosure to the people moving in that there was a non-certified renovation, is there?
Which was, but there is disclosure about lead-based paint hazards in the home, which EPA initially determined would provide a homeowner the opportunity, should provide the homeowner incentive to ask about, ask for, if, to the extent they were concerned about it, if they had young children, they had a pregnant woman, to ask further questions about what had happened.
But so is it unreasonable for the agency to say that we will protect more people by our new rule, because although some people may be aggressive enough to ask the seller, there will certainly be some who won't. And for those who aren't or are not knowledgeable enough about this, or for any other reason don't ask, this will protect them. Why is that unreasonable to think that more people will be protected by eliminating the opt-out rule?
We're not necessarily saying at the end of the day, it may not be unreasonable to take that position, but we don't think EPA has adequately explained itself in the rule as to why the disclosure rule is in fact not a sufficient means of providing protection, given the fact, for example, that as EPA itself found, a number of, in fact, perhaps the majority of contractors follow the work practices anyway.
The statute doesn't say, EPA, we want a sufficient solution to this problem. If it said that, you might have an argument. But that's not what the statute says. It doesn't say it has to be, all we want is a sufficient solution.
Well, but keep in mind, Your Honor, that Congress, when it enacted the Residential Lead Hazard Reduction Act 1992, did not say we're here to provide a society-wide solution to the problem of lead in homes. Congress specifically decided to exclude from the ambit of this regulation, this is something nobody contests, a huge segment of renovation activities that are conducted in homes, and those are renovation activities that are conducted by the homeowners themselves, so-called do-it-yourselfers. So this is not an attempt by Congress to, get every single renovation activity that might.
Is your position that this is unlawful, that the statute does not permit this result?
No.
Until this moment, your argument was that they hadn't explained their reversal, not that they were going beyond what they were permitted by the statute. You're not making that.
No, Your Honor, I certainly don't mean to suggest that.
So your argument is, although what they might do might be permitted by the statute, they haven't reasonably explained why they reversed their position. That's your argument, correct?
That's our principal argument, correct, Your Honor.
Could I ask you one quite specific question? You say at page 15 of your reply brief, you make a mismatch argument in the cost-benefit analysis and say that the estimating benefits, EPA assumed that no contractors were employing the work practices required, and then but it's paragraph isn't entirely clear, but you cite page 283 of the joint appendix, and I was just wondering what exactly you got out of page 283, because I didn't get anything out of 283 like that passage at 15 of your reply brief.
Well, at page 283, Your Honor, I think if you read that, first of all, refers to the crude benefits numbers, so EPA is acknowledging that it did a fairly crude job here. But in answer to your question, there's nothing here, as we read it on page 283, that suggests that in calculating the benefits that EPA was making the same sort of allowance for the fact that contractors, the majority of contractors, it found in its telephone survey, were following the work practices anyway. There's no indication here in their description of the benefits that, I agree with you, they don't specifically say they didn't, but there's nothing here in the description of the benefits that indicates that they were making that same allowance. And so the suggestion is, we believe, that in calculating the benefits, that they were looking at the benefits, assuming that none of those work practices were being followed.
So that's an assumption on your part?
Well, again, we believe we don't see anything in here that suggests that they were taking that into account.
Do you agree they took it into account in 2008? In calculating benefits?
I don't recall offhand, Your Honor, whether they didn't.
Okay. Anything further?
Yes, I actually have further. Well, in the 2008 rule, renovation rule, the economic analysis, which is the same basic economic analysis as you point out, right, that they've done here. I'm right about that, right? It's basically the same. They said, quote, at page 5, chapter 5.1, in some cases, contractors are already taking precautions even without the rule. RRP events with precautions already in place are not included in the benefits calculations. Only those RRP events performed without appropriate precautions are included in the calculations.
In other words, did you go back to check to see whether or not, in fact, by basing their 2010 calculation on the 2008 calculation, they in fact were comparing apples to apples? They took into account the voluntary activities. I mean, your reply brief suggests they didn't. But if you go back and look at what they did in 2008, they did. That's why I asked you. You're making a suggestion, but you said you didn't know what they did in 2008. But if you look, they did take into account the voluntary activities.
I stand corrected.
Well, let me ask just two other quick questions. This argument that you make, which is an interesting argument about incremental, having to do the same increment on both sides, I don't find it raised either in your opening brief or in your comments. So I'll give you a chance to look while you know, in between now and when you come up again. But you know, I was surprised that the agency hadn't answered it, and then I realized it wasn't raised until the reply. And I've looked back at the comments, and I don't see it raised at all. But I'll give you a chance to find whether it was.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stephanie Talbert, and I represent EPA in this matter. With me at council table is Andrew Simons from EPA's Office of General Counsel. In 2008, the agency passed the renovation rule, with the opt-out provision, providing an exception for a subset of target housing through the opt-out provision. The agency then was sued. It, in that settlement agreement, agreed to reconsider the opt-out provision. It did so and reached the opposite conclusion based on the record. It found that it did not have the record to support the opt-out provision in 2008, and actually the record better supports extending protection to those segments of societies that were not protected by the opt-out provision. I'd like to start with petitioners.
Better support, I mean, you don't have, as we've just been through exhaustively, you don't have to show that it better supports the removal of the opt-out provision. But you're claiming the record does show that it better supports it?
EPA believes it better supports removing the opt-out provision.
Go ahead.
EPA found that renovation activities in target housing generate lead-based paint hazards far in excess of the regulatory hazard standard. And for that reason, hazards in opt-out housing could remain when people with young children and pregnant women move into housing, that housing. EPA also found that exterior renovations could cause high levels of lead dust to migrate from the renovation, contaminating neighboring properties, so the people living in those homes would also have a likelihood of being exposed to high lead dust levels. So EPA re-examined that information, focusing primarily on the opt-out provision, and concluded that the eliminating the opt-out provision was safer for the people in those categories. I would like to just...
There didn't seem to be any focus on this, and doubtless I could have found it in the record. How exactly is renovation defined? I mean, we get a painter in to repaint a wall. Are we under it?
I believe it's disturbing 2 square feet of material.
Disturbing.
Speaking from personal experience, your painter will give you a brochure and a form to sign, all right?
We'll take judicial notice of that.
Yes.
Disturbing. So covering with another coat of paint is disturbing?
Your Honor, I have to say I'm not exactly sure what exactly constitutes renovation activity, but my belief from the record is that it's something more than painting. It's disturbing, generating dust that could accumulate on the floors or windowsills or leave
a little sanding, normally highly recommended before repainting.
Seriously, I've just been through this, patching a hole in the ceiling, a very small area, less than 3 feet square, with a little sanding, a little plaster patching, and I got this long brochure and a form to sign, and I was very impressed at how this was being implemented.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Idle curiosity.
Well, that there is something about about this rule that everyone can get their arms around, and the basic thing that EPA was doing here is saying there are additional people we could cover, and we think that better effectuates what we're supposed to be doing under the statute.
Can I ask a question about the statute? Certification determination. It says the administrator shall revise regulations under subsection it says within 4 years after October 28, 1992, comma, which apparently is a deadline that EPA missed quite a long time ago. The EPA shall revise the regulations under subsection A to apply the regulations to renovation or remodeling activities in target housing, comma, public buildings constructed before 1978, comma, and commercial buildings that create lead-based paint hazards. Is the EPA's view that the phrase that create lead-based paint hazards applies to all three items, target housing, public buildings constructed before 78, and commercial buildings, or that it applies only to the last and commercial buildings that create lead-based paint hazards? I don't think it's particularly decisive, but I am interested. You see what I'm talking about?
Yes. Well, I think EPA does agree with that, at least.
Agree with what?
With the fact that create lead-based paint hazards applies.
To all three?
Specifically target housing here. That's what
EPA... That's the way the brief read, which is that you have to show that it's... And target housing that create lead-based paint hazards rather than just being about commercial buildings.
Right. And that's what EPA concluded when it found that these significant levels of lead dust are generated when renovation activities disturb lead-based paint.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I would just like to respond to something that petitioner focused on, and that is the agency's reliance on the disclosure rule in promulgating the 2008 renovation rule with the opt-out provision. EPA acknowledged that it relied on the disclosure rule and came to terms with it in the preamble of the opt-out amendment. EPA said, we no longer think that that provides any protection to people moving in. It provides them with information only if there is information to give. And there's nothing in the renovation rule that requires sellers to have information about lead-based paint, so they wouldn't necessarily have information to give to purchasers. And furthermore, the disclosure rule doesn't require...
There's no requirement If you have lead base paint and you know about it, you don't have to disclose that?
You do have to disclose it, right. But a seller wouldn't know necessarily that there was lead base paint in the property after renovation.
I see.
And would have nothing then to give to the purchasers. And also the disclosure rule doesn't require any work practices like the renovation rule does to specifically address and significantly reduce the levels of lead dust that remain in the home.
I'm sorry, just to get clear on the disclosure rule as it existed, a person who's covered by the opt-out, who opted out and then sold, had no obligation to disclose the renovation?
That's right. No obligation to disclose the renovation and no reason to have information about the existence of lead-based paint hazards in the home. And unless the court has further questions, I think I will rest on my brief.
Thank you. Counsel for petition.
Just a couple points quickly. First, in response to your prior question, Judge Garland, we did not raise the apples and oranges argument specifically in our initial brief. We were responding to an argument in EPA's brief. We had made an argument about the costs.
Right.
In our original brief, they came back and said, yeah, you know.
We did cost,
but remember, we also did benefits, and there are three times.
Yeah.
So that was the context for our raising that issue.
How about in the comments? Did you make the apples and oranges argument in the comments filed with the agency? The only thing I can find in the comments, I don't mean to preempt if you have the answer. You don't have a page for me to look at.
I'm afraid I don't.
The only thing I found is just a general statement that the agency has to consider the economic implications, which of course is exactly what the statute says. But I didn't find a specific argument about apples and oranges, which, you know, it's a good argument, but I just don't see it having been raised before the agency. That's all. You don't have a place to point me to.
I'm afraid I don't right at the moment, Mr. Garland. And just in response to Judge Williams, strictly just simply painting a wall in and of itself would not constitute renovation under this rule.
Sanding
would. That's right, because it creates lead dust. So, you know, if Judge Rogers, you know, had her the area that was going to be painted sanded, then that would have triggered the renovation. And again, it doesn't take a whole lot in terms of area to get covered by this rule. So one other point I did want to raise quickly, because I hadn't brought it up before in connection with costs. Again, we've made the point in our brief about the fact that EPA did not convene a small business advisory review panel, an SBAR panel, for purposes of this rule. They relied on a panel report that was 10 years old.
This is a new point, all right, but they say in their brief there's no judicial review available to you on this.
Well, we think, 2 points on that, Your Honor. We think that the court would have the authority to review this under Section 604, which talks about what EPA has to do in issuing a final analysis.
But one of the things that EPA says you're making a 609 claim.
609B claim.
B claim, yeah.
Well, but again, under Section 604 talks about what an agency has to do in issuing a final analysis, and one of the things it has to do is talk about its assessment of impacts on small businesses, has to talk about the alternatives it reviewed, has to talk about the considerations it took into account.
The problem I think Judge Rogers is alluding to is that the statute in the judicial review provision says agency compliance with Section 607 and 609A shall be judicially reviewable in connection with judicial review under Section 604. And you're raising a 609B claim. So the statute seems to preclude this argument.
Well, again, we think the statute's broad enough, but even if it's not, under this court's ruling in the Allied Council case, the court can still take into account EPA's failure to convene an SBAR panel in determining whether the agency's action overall issuing the rule was arbitrary and capricious.
I think that's right. Although in Allied, the issue was the RFA process had generated a lot of evidence. And then the question was, did the agency arbitrarily deal with the evidence that it had generated, regardless of whether it had to generate the evidence, or regardless of whether it could have reviewed the failure to? But the way the argument is in this case, I think the best argument you can make, and tell me if there's more to it than that, is that the failure to convene a panel is arbitrary and capricious.
Well, I think in this case, that's right, Your Honor.
Why? And if that's true, though, that's isn't that basically the same thing as saying that the failure to convene a panel is reviewable, and isn't that what the agency precluded, what the statute precludes? Isn't it just another route to exactly the same review?
Well, I'm not sure it's exactly the same, Your Honor. It's one thing to say that, you know, sort of in black and white terms, you didn't do this, therefore you violated the statute. It's another thing to say you didn't do this, and therefore in looking at all the considerations we look at in determining whether an agency action is arbitrary and capricious, we weigh this in. And on balance, we find that the failure in these particular circumstances, in this particular case, is arbitrary and capricious. And we think that's certainly the case here because, again, the agency was relying on a 10-year-old panel report that hadn't specifically looked at this issue and was done in circumstances that were very different economically.
So you're not making the argument that every failure to convene a panel is arbitrary and capricious. Your argument is that under the context of this case.
In the context of this case, that's exactly right.
Okay.
And would that be true as well, given that the agency responded to the comments that were submitted regarding costs and the change economic environment?
Oh, I think it would, Your Honor, because, again, the convening of the Small Business Advocacy Review Panel has a specific purpose within the overall context of the SBRIFA statute. It's designed to, you know, force, if you will, EPA to sit down with representatives of affected small entities and, you know, essentially talk to them face to face and deal with them directly, and not necessarily the same way they would in the arm's length in the normal APA review and comment process.
What I'm getting at is your first argument is there were no new facts, there was no experience, so nothing's changed, yet EPA's changing the rule. Now on this argument, you want to say everything's changed and they had to convene this panel even though they had to convene this panel in order to avoid being arbitrary and capricious. Even though they invited comments and the comments were extensive on costs, and EPA responded in detail as to why it concluded that cost was not an obstacle here.
Well, for purposes of this argument, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with your characterization that we're not saying that everything has changed. What we're saying is that the economic conditions in particular are very different in 2010, particularly for small businesses.
And the comments made those points. That's why I'm just trying to understand here. In other words, if EPA got the information about the changed economic conditions, the impact on small businesses, and you don't have the right to appeal a 609 B determination, then how do we find it's arbitrary and capricious?
Again, I would submit to you, Your Honor, that the Small Business Advocacy Review Panel has a specific purpose. It's not the same as just allowing comment. And I would also note that EPA was fairly dismissive of comments.
They went on for pages.
Well,
they didn't just say we disagreed.
But they were dismissive of comments that were submitted by some NHB members saying that we think your cost estimates are way too low. There is, if you look in the record.
What information are you telling the court a panel would have brought to EPA's attention that was not brought to EPA's attention through the comments, pretermitting for the moment whether it would have made any difference or not in EPA's decision?
Again, I think there's a difference, Your Honor, between EPA accepting comments as part of the normal APA review process.
Not accepting, responding to.
Well, but again, responding to, with all due respect.
Okay, we differ on our characterization, yes, of whether they dismissed them dismissively.
Well, I mean, they said, Your Honor, I don't want to drag this out, but they said, Your Honor, there's a statement in the response to comments that says that basically, you know, that these comment, the people who are more likely to comment are those who are not happy with our characterization. And therefore, they are somehow sort of outliers. They're not, if you will, the silent majority. And therefore, you know, we can just kind of dismiss them. And, you know, we think that that reflects, frankly, a certain mindset in responding to these comments. If you have the SBAR panel, again, it requires EPA in a more focused, formalized way to address, to listen to the comments from the small entity representatives.
So it's, you don't actually have comments in mind that would have been submitted under that process that were not submitted anyway. Rather, your argument is that it would have required the agency to focus more.
It's a process point, Your Honor. That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.